This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Ted Howard, co-founder of the Democracy Collective, and Marjorie Kelly, author of The Divine Right of Capital and Owning Our Future, have teamed up to co-author The Making of a Democratic Economy. Whoa, democratic economy? A clarion call for a movement ready to get serious about transforming our economic system.
The authors illuminate the principles of a democratic economy through its stories on the underground community wealth building and their unlikely accomplices in the halls of institutional power. The book is a must-read for everybody concerned with how we can win the fight for an economy that's equitable, not extractive. Now Marjorie Kelly and Ted Howard talk to us about building blocks to economically and politically empower the people.
The making of a democratic economy. That is our subject. And of course, it's juxtaposed with many from the left who would say, you can't, short of maintenance or ownership of the means of production by the working class, there isn't any kind of interim process. It's a kind of all or nothing. So how do you look at and understand the making of a democratic economy and the kind of essential mechanism that you talk about for doing that, which is the issue of cooperative development?
I think it's good to start with what a democratic economy is not. We talk about GDP being up and stock market being up and unemployment is low, and isn't that a good economy? But for most people, it's not. 47% of Americans can't put together even $400 in an emergency. So we really have two different economies, one that serves the few and one that people are left behind. And what we are talking about is how a different economy is already being built. It's happening all over. We don't see it. We're not talking about it enough, but it's growing at the grassroots. It's growing in cities. There's some very different kinds of things happening, and it's not capitalism as we know it. It's not socialism as we know it. You know, that's a binary choice. Those are 19th century concepts. The democratic economies, let's take democratic values and bring them into the economy. And that's a different kind of approach.
Ted, would you agree with that, or you want to expand on that?
Maybe just expansion, because Mimi mentioned the concept of cooperative development. When we think of a democratic economy, what we're pointing to is new patterns of ownership over capital and business and assets in our economy. The ownership of assets and who controls them and deploys them, and similarly with capital in a larger sense, that's at the very heart of any economic system. Right now, capital is owned by an extraordinarily small number of individuals and large hyper-corporate capitalist institutions and businesses. Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, and Warren Buffett own more wealth than the bottom 160 million Americans. So there's this incredible concentration of wealth and ownership, and it's escalating and getting worse in the last 10 years. What we're suggesting is that there are new design principles on which to base an economy other than something like maximizing shareholder value or wealth accumulation by the 1%. Some of this is what maybe historically could be called socialism, public ownership. Now, there are lots of assets owned by municipal governments, state governments. That's a form of public ownership. It's socialized ownership. But then there are also ways of organizing assets through cooperative businesses. Here in Cleveland, we've started a network of the Evergreen Cooperatives. These are owned by the workers in them. They're not owned by the city. They're not owned by the state. They're owned on a democratic basis by the people who work in these firms, who contribute their labor, and we believe should share in their profits. And these companies also contribute 10% of their profit to a fund designed to create new businesses that are cooperatives in the city. So there are many ways of broadening ownership over capital. Just think it an old concept to think that we're talking about the ownership has to all be the state or the government. That needs to be part of it, but a lot of it is about community and working people in these firms.
Ted, since you brought up the Cleveland cooperatives, and that's one of the ones that's most mentioned as being the most developed, could you flesh that out in terms of what kinds of cooperatives we're talking about and how they sustain themselves?
I've been involved with the Evergreen Cooperatives since their launch. We're celebrating the 10th anniversary of the first of these businesses, the Evergreen Cooperative Laundry, which is really quite something because most smaller businesses go out of business in the first 5 years of their existence. The idea here was to focus business development of a cooperative worker-owned nature in the lowest income neighborhoods of Cleveland, Ohio. Cleveland is one of the three poorest cities in America. So there's been this vast deindustrialization. There's been the flight of capital, the flight of jobs, and people leaving the city. Population's down from almost 1 million to 385,000. Well, what is the future of Cleveland? And we realized that we could draw on the purchasing power of the big institutions that are left here, the hospitals, the universities, the cultural centers, and drive those contracts into the local community and use them to catalyze the development of a new network of businesses. We wanted to hire people who had been most marginalized in the overall capitalist economy, ex-offenders, people who dropped out of school in the eighth grade and so forth. We had a mantra, which it was, a job alone is not enough. We need to create employment opportunities that not only pay a decent living wage, family supporting, not only give benefits, but allow people to accumulate wealth for themselves, their family, and their communities. So we've organized a network of, I guess, five or six businesses now, worker-owned. There are about 250 to 300 people working in these. Most of them are increasingly members of the co-op, so they own a share of the companies. They're the greenest companies in their sector. One of them is called the Evergreen Cooperative Laundry, cleaning now almost 30 million pounds of laundry and sheets and towels and so forth for the health systems in the area, all completely owned by the people that work in it who are sharing in the profits. And this whole network is growing. And we feel there the city has been very supportive in helping to extend low-interest loans and so forth. But this is not city socialism strategy. It's a worker cooperative strategy with a democratic workplace. We're excited. It's on a trajectory of growth. We're growing 3 million heads of lettuce in downtown Cleveland, 300,000 pounds of basil, and a giant 3.5-acre food production hydroponic greenhouse. We have a green energy company. This is a way to put people back to work and actually give them a way to enter the economy and not just work for somebody, but have a stake in the company that they're working in. And that's just one of the stories that we tell in this book about how new forms of enterprise designed with very different principles than a traditional corporation can really lead to great benefit and the revitalization of a local economy.
Marjorie Kelly, I want you to help us envision the making of democratic economy, the ideological principles that go into the making of a democratic economy, which you certainly delineate through the stories, which we will continue to flesh out in our discussion. But the actual principles that have to be one of both different kind of economic quality, a kind of equitableness rather than an extractive model, and also I would maintain a democratic decision-making process as opposed to an autocratic, a kind of hierarchical model of wealth accumulation. That is how most of our work sites function. So can you talk about some of those seminal ideas that have led to the kind of cooperative development that Ted just spoke about?
Yeah, so in the book, we make a distinction between what we call the extractive economy and the democratic economy. And an extractive economy is designed for maximum extraction of wealth and goes mostly to an elite. You know, and a democratic economy rebuilds all of that around different principles. I mean, system science tells us that social systems are built around values. What is it that we value? It's not about regulations in particular. It's about what is it that we really value. And so the first is really community. I mean, we're in this together, right? I mean, this is not every man for himself, every woman for himself. That's more the extractive model. So we're in this together. And what Ted was talking about is what that looks like in Cleveland when people get together and, you know, are helping build companies that hire the hard to employ. So that's community. That's the start of an economy of by and for the people. It's also inclusion. I mean, people of color by 2030 will be the majority of people in this country, and they have far less wealth than white people and have been systematically excluded. So how do we build an economy that systematically includes them? We look at Portland, Oregon, and how that city's economic development department completely reoriented itself around racial and gender inclusion. Also place. I mean, we live in this globalized, financialized economy. You know, you locate production anywhere in the world, mostly chosen on other lax regulations, other low labor costs. That's what place means in an extractive economy. But people live someplace real. People care about place. People in Cleveland care about Cleveland, so they're coming together. And anchor institutions in other cities are working on issues of place. And a principle of good work. Now we have an economy that is systematically expelling labor income. And labor, if it can, it's taken many forms. There was globalizing of production. There was outsourcing, turning jobs into part-time, contingent, Uberized kind of jobs. You know, close to 40% of jobs today are insecure jobs like those. And what would it mean if we actually put labor at the center and said, let's build a worker-centered economy? We visit Cooperative Home Care Associates in the Bronx, which is a 30-year-old company that does precisely that, that puts workers at the center. Also sustainability, right? Sustainability and community really are in a way the same thing. We can't have a healthy economy if the planet is in trouble. So we look at what would that mean if we put the ecosystem and, you know, sustainability of life on Earth. It came before profits for ExxonMobil. You know, imagine that. So one of the things we look at is what if we just bought out the big fossil fuel companies and began to wind them down and, you know, took seriously this issue of sustainability. And then ethical finance. I mean, you still need finance, right? But what if instead of taking every dime out of everybody's pocket that's possible, we said, no, finance exists to serve people and place and planet. You can build banks around that. Bank of North Dakota, it's owned by the people of the state and has helped that whole state do well in the 2008 downturn. And there's now a movement across the country for state-owned and city-owned banks. Those are the core principles that we talk about.
I just want to underscore one thing Marjorie said, and it's this distinction of capital and labor. Many of your listeners know about the Mondragon cooperatives in the Basque country of Spain, which really are the leading example of worker ownership around the world, with a network of about 120 companies, about 75,000 worker owners in these companies. I visited them 5 or 6 times because it's a very different model of economy. And to make this very real, I asked them, what is the difference between what you're doing here with this worker ownership and what in a country like the United States we do? And they said, in your system, by which they mean the kind of casino capitalism that we live under, capital is in first place over labor. So whenever you have a financial decision or you get in trouble with a company, you drive to preserve capital, and that is, in other words, the ownership of the investors. And one of the ways you preserve it is you shed as much labor as you can to preserve the capital. To Mondragon, we know capital is essential. You can't build a business without capital. But labor is in first place over capital. So when we make our decisions, we're always asking, how do we keep our people at work, even in the tough times? And so that simple design distinction leads to very different outcomes. So right outside of Cleveland, there's a town called Lordstown, where one of the large automobile companies has closed a factory with about 3,000 workers in it. Just shut it down, unwound it, 3,000 people lost their jobs, and oh, by the way, if you want to move to Arizona, you might be able to work there. But, you know, people have families and all that. In Mondragon, a few years ago, one of their big flagship companies collapsed because it had been undercut through cheaper Chinese electronic products that they were trying to compete with. But in Mondragon, they didn't say 3,000 people are losing your jobs. They set up a whole process so that first people had employment support for 2 years, and the companies that were more successful absorbed the workers from the company that collapsed, such that today there are only about 200 of the workers who still haven't found employment. That's, you know, we just don't do that in the United States. That's why when Marjorie points to the principles underlying a democratic economy, they're not just sort of nice features. They become the driver for how you view the world and what decisions you make as a consequence of them.
Let me just build on that. Worker-owned companies in the U.S., and there are thousands of them, have been known that layoffs are much less likely. People are one-fourth as likely to be laid off at employee-owned firms in the U.S.
And, Roger, you had mentioned the worker-owned co-op in the Bronx, a very large one, home care workers, who are oftentimes very much exploited. Could you tell us how that works and how large it is and what's going with that? And also, is there any involvement by the labor union 1199?
Yes, Cooperative Home Care Associates is this amazing company. It's been around 33 years. It's been profitable. You walk into this company, the first thing you see is their mission emblazoned on the wall, you know, creating better health through better jobs. It's 100% owned by its workers. These are low-income women, many of them Latinas, many of them black women. And they're out in the homes caring for the elderly, the disabled, people on Medicaid. So it can be potentially an isolating work. And they started this company to create a place where these women would belong, where they would feel included. They've succeeded at that. They have workers select the members of the board. Many workers actually serve on the board. It's a unionized company. They have a labor management committee where problems can be resolved. They do work closely with 1199. You know, in New York, the minimum wage has gone to $15. And that was a big jump for this company. They went from 11 to 15 overnight. And because the money comes from Medicaid through a mediating health care organization and then goes to CHCA as a contractor, not every dime of the increase gets passed through to CHCA. And so they have been working with 1199 to help create better enforcement with these agencies. And I was told by the CEO there that not everybody can benefit from having 1199 involved, but they have found them just tremendously helpful in going to bat for this company.
Is not Cooperative Home Care Associates the largest worker cooperative in the United States? Is something like over 2,000 workers and members.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Let me just stop you for a moment to let our listeners know that we're speaking with Marjorie Kelly and Ted Howard of the Democracy Collective, and we're interrogating the book, The Making of a Democratic Economy, Building Prosperity for the Many, Not Just for the Few. And I'm sorry, Marjorie, please continue.
Well, what I wanted to say, there is now a movement to replicate Cooperative Home Care Associates, and there are 15 worker-owned home care companies now in formation or in existence. So it's an example of proving a model and then working to take it to scale. That's part of the process of the making of a democratic economy. You have proof of concept, and then you find ways to grow it.
I just want to push back a little bit, not in terms of the actuality of things, but conceptually in the mass culture. Many of us, for example, in New York, who've been active in the tenant movement for many years, have long advocated for housing in the public domain. And there's a tremendous hostility amongst tenants themselves to that concept that government and or worker ownership and cooperative is a messy business, that we should have a kind of professional managerial class that makes the decisions or things will go horribly awry, that collective decision-making processes, they become ultra-democratic and destructive. As we talk about a future beyond corporate capitalism, I wonder if you can both address that in the development of the cooperative process, the actual decision-making, as well as the economic conceptualization of a more equalization of the wealth that is generated by the cooperative.
There can be a lot of misunderstandings when you do something like employee ownership. People think, oh, hey, I'm the boss now. That means I get to make the decisions. And you know, there's a difference between ownership and management. And companies know how to do training to really bring people along. There are misunderstandings, I think, on all sides. But, you know, see, Mimi, you talked about people saying, well, we don't really like, you know, this government ownership of housing, and we don't like collective decision making. It can be messy, but I would also hearken back to the challenges when feminism was new, for example, and people were like, well, you know, we don't really want women as leaders because men are more this or that. So there's a lot of cultural misunderstandings that I think will be resolved over time.
And I would add, based on the experience of the Evergreen cooperatives, if you remember the movie The Matrix from a few years ago, where it looked to everybody like we're just living in normal society. And then, you know, in that science fiction story, everybody was enslaved by these, you know, machines. In a sense, we're kind of living in the Matrix, because there are all these myths about capitalism and the economy. Everybody believes things like, to have an effective leader of a business, they have to go to the Stanford Business School. And, well, tell me about it, leaders of Enron, you know, how that worked out, if you're all so good. And then there's, you know, if we just grow the economy, it'll just trickle down and it'll help, you know, everybody. Well, until very recently, I moved downtown Cleveland, but for 5 years I lived in a neighborhood called Glenville here in Cleveland. About 20,000 people live there, 98% African-American community, where the average life expectancy for a man, and therefore an African-American man, is 64 years. And 8 miles directly east is in a white suburb of Cleveland, where the life expectancy for a man is 88 years. 24 years of life in 8 miles closely correlated to income and wealth. And there has been regional growth, but I can tell you it is not trickling down. Or that a rising tide raises all boats. All these kinds of assumptions. Mm. So when we built the Evergreen cooperatives, first of all, we made a commitment that we were not going to discriminate against anyone who had a criminal record. We simply wanted to know what the circumstances were so we could be supportive. About half of the people we hired were ex-offenders, some of them felons who'd been incarcerated 10 years and literally had no work history. We brought them through the right training into the company. We then started training in the culture of the company. We had professional management, people who knew how to run a laundry and had worked in that field for 20 or 30 years, because that's very complicated. But we brought people in and then invested in them, and gave them an opportunity, first, for some elements of democracy, step by step. So the first was to elect some members to the board from among the other workers, and then do training with them about what is their fiduciary and legal responsibility of a board, and then to give them the power to vote new members into the cooperative who they'd be working with. It's their decision, not some skilled manager's decision who had worked in the company. And over time, people started to rise to become supervisors. We do open book financial management and train people on how to read a profit and loss statement. And step by step, the ownership of the company has become deeply invested in the people that work there. And that's what's making it work. And one of the most poignant statements I ever heard from a worker in Evergreen, one of the very first people who was hired, he'd been incarcerated 2 times. He was living in his car when we hired him. He had lost his family because of jail, all kinds of devastation to his life. And I asked him, what does this opportunity to be a worker owner of this evergreen laundry mean to you? And I thought he was going to say, well, I have cash in my pocket, and that's a great thing. He didn't say that. He said, I never thought a person with my life experience would ever be able to be an owner of a company like this. And that's what this is about, is really shattering the social barriers and ceilings that we have over people in the society and giving them an opportunity to really express who they are. And we have found in the Evergreen Cooperatives, most people when we started said, you cannot possibly make a company like this work, hiring these people, making it green, putting it in the worst neighborhoods. We found that that's actually the ingredient to success, because people aren't working for the man, they're working for themselves and for their community.
Is there a role for the federal or state or even city governments in encouraging co-ops?
There's a big role. So that's one thing, and we talk about it in the book. There are the wonderful models and examples and stories and new narratives. But there is a very big role for policy and regulatory reform. For instance, there's not a national cooperative law from the federal government. Each state has its own version of a cooperative law. When we began here in Ohio, there was a very, very antiquated law, and it was all about rural farmers co-ops. So we actually had to work to change that law to, you know, help facilitate the creation of worker cooperatives, which is very, very different. There are city governments can change their procurement guidelines to award extra points for local employee-owned or worker-owned businesses in bidding on contracts, because it's a better bet for the city to put the money into a local kind of indigenous community-owned company rather than give the contract to some big firm on Wall Street and the money gets sucked out of the community and you don't get a multiplier effect. And so there's lots of that sort of thing that can provide a conducive environment to do not only cooperative development, but public banking. There's a huge movement in this country around public banking. There's one public bank of North Dakota that was created in the early 1900s during the Progressive Era. And because North Dakota, which is a very conservative state, has this legacy public bank where the state government puts all its deposits and does its business, during the height of the Great Recession, North Dakota weathered it much better than most other states because you had a public, almost socialized financial institution that kept lending. Public banking legislation is going through state legislatures in places like California and many others. And so there's certainly a very important piece of policy work that needs to go hand in hand with building these models.
I am now convinced by Marjorie, Kelly, and Ted Howard, and the book, The Making of a Democratic Economy, Building Prosperity for the Many, Not Just the Few. I want to thank you both for being with us. This has been most instructive, most informative, and definitely encourage our listeners to get The Making of a Democratic Economy. It's a prima. It's a model towards an encouragement to building a new economic model that is far more democratic and perhaps the dismantling of corporate capitalism.
And tune in next week for part two of The Making of a Democratic Economy with Ted Howard and Marjorie Kelly from the Democracy Collaborative.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.